ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A young scientist flees Nazi Germany and ends up building the atomic bomb for Britain and America. But behind the lab coat, he's a Soviet spy. Klaus Fuchs, the physicist who decided the fate of the world and gave the West's greatest secrets to the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app or look for it on the ABC Rewind podcast feed.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Today, as I continue to look back on some of your favourite stories, we have to talk about the weather. Have you seen the Bureau of Meteorology's revamped website? To say that people had strong opinions about it when it first launched is an understatement. But the flood of reactions proved one thing, and it's that you love weather. It's about so much more than just small talk. So what is it about the weather that has us so obsessed? Also ahead, with the ability to use AI to resurrect the dead, are we making it harder for them to rest in peace? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. Across the country, there are about 45,000 children in out-of-home care, and about 8,000 are in a foster care home. These kids rely on foster carers who open their homes, who feed and clothe them, provide emotional support, and often help them stay connected to their birth families. But in Victoria, some foster carers are reporting sudden reductions in their allowances for looking after kids with high-level needs. And it highlights the ongoing challenges around the country when it comes to finding foster carers for children who need safe and stable homes. The number of foster carer families has been dropping across all states and territories over the last 5 years. Cost of living pressures, low carer allowances, and carers feeling undervalued. It all adds up to a system that's letting down carers and vulnerable children. So what needs to change? Well, Samantha Hogarth is Chief Executive of the Foster Care Association of Victoria and is with me now. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you, Tegan. Thank you for having me.
So, Samantha, a couple of months ago, your group started getting calls from foster carers. What were they telling you?
Over the last few months, Tegan, we've been, receiving a growing number of calls and anecdotally hearing from our carers who are experiencing a reduction in their care allowance level, often resulting in a reduction from a higher care allowance level, like the child was assessed to have high level needs, down to basic one carer level payment. And the care allowance, just for your listeners, is a financial contribution towards the day-to-day costs incurred while providing care for a child or young person.
And you need to remember, complex needs maybe need a bit more funding.
Absolutely. We've got five categories here in Victoria, and the higher levels, the level four and five, are meant to reflect, you know, the additional time, experience, expense involved in supporting a child with greater behavioural, emotional, medical, developmental challenges. You know, at the higher level, those children present often with, you know, several physical, psychological issues. They require extensive structure, strong routine, a lot of therapeutic support to undertake daily activities, you know, things like speech therapy, occupational therapy, numerous paediatric appointments. And what's clear is that those carers at that level are providing, you know, 24/7, round-the-clock care.
Do you have a sense of how many families are affected?
Well, our hotline has been receiving, you know, a number of calls from carers who have experienced this situation. It'd be fair to say that we're unlikely to be aware of all of them. Just one carer actually in this situation is too many. Mm. And the fact that level one payments in Victoria issued at all is just widely insufficient. We have the lowest level one care allowance in Australia, which is nowhere, you know, near meeting the true costs of caring for a child, let alone the costs of, you know, raising a child in care that usually, you know, come from a trauma background and, you know, have very complex needs. So that shortfall places enormous financial pressure on our carers. And, you know, it really is driving many to leave the system altogether.
It's not just this one issue. You sort of say you've been hearing these calls over the last few months, but it sounds like it's sort of one contributor to a bigger trend that you've been observing.
Yes, look, definitely. Like I was saying, you know, in Victoria, our care allowance is just not keeping pace with inflation. Household inflation has been up around 6-7% in recent years. Our care allowance here has only increased by 2-2.5%, with no increase, you know, in the true value of our allowance since 2016, when back then it was only increased by $20. That was 8 years ago. So here carers are really doing it tough, and it's not fair. And I should just say that our basic care allowance is, you know, approximately $31 a day. And that's to cover everything from recreational, educational, health, therapeutic and daily living expenses, like, you know, providing food, nappies, formula, clothing, transportation. It's far below what's needed. But in contrast, the New South Wales government has recently, you know, recognised the need to increase their care allowance. And the stark contrast, for example, is that you'll have a child living in New South Wales, a 14-year-old child, and a 14-year-old child here. There's a difference of $400 per fortnight in that care allowance to what our Victorian carer would receive. We're losing more good carers than we are recruiting.
Samantha, as you say, each state sort of has its own department that handles child protection, like foster care. We did reach out to the Victorian government. A spokesperson told us that foster and kinship carers do an outstanding job supporting children who cannot live safely with their immediate family, and we value the work that they do. Care allowance levels vary based on age and needs of a child and can be reassessed as a child's needs changed. It's not related to budget, says this statement. There has been no change, the spokesperson said, in the care allowance policy. Well, just to cast the net a bit wider across the country, Renee Lee is also with me. She's the CEO of Adopt Change and a member of the National Foster and Kinship Care Collective. Renee, the challenges that we're hearing Samantha describe here, are they being felt Australia-wide?
Morning, Tegan. Look, I think if we look at the bottom line of how many children in the care system aren't in a family-based home, so they're not with foster carers or kinship carers, that's at around 10%, so around 4,800 children, which really demonstrates the shortage of home-based care. So we're seeing people who are no longer staying in the care system as a foster carer, and we're not seeing the same number of entries. So it certainly is a nationwide felt problem.
I have a text here, Renee. One person says, why do First Nations people who are kinship carers get paid even less than foster carers? Refer to the Yuruk testimonies.
There's carer payments, as Samantha was talking about before, in each state. So as well as the foster carers that you mentioned, in terms of the 8,000, 45% of the carers are kinship or relative carers. And so it will depend based on the jurisdiction that a carer is based in. And we also see that there are informal carers, particularly in this space where a relative will take in a child and they're not part of the authorised system, and they are certainly very unsupported financially.
We heard Samantha say before just the huge discrepancy between what a carer in Victoria would be getting for a child of a certain age versus the same situation but in New South Wales. Is it appropriate that it varies so dramatically across the country?
No, they're the same children needing the same level of care, and the same amazing carers who have the same cost of living challenges. So to be a carer, you need space in your home and the ability to care for a child and take time when needed to take them to appointments, etc. So it really is a question of viability. Carers, both foster and kinship carers, are volunteers, and the amount is quite small in terms of going towards the child's needs and caring for them. So really, in New South Wales, the reason there's been an increase is around the advocacy and the recognition that carers need the allowance increase just to be able to afford the role that they have taken on. So really, from a national perspective, this needs to be taken up elsewhere as well, because it has been recognised in New South Wales. It needs to be recognised across Australia.
What happens if the number of foster carers gets so low? What happens to those children?
Unfortunately, they're quite terrible outcomes. So we see with the 10%, so around 4,800 kids end up in a residential group setting, so essentially a group home with shift workers where children grow up instead of being placed with a family and having that sense of normality. And then a step down from that is being placed in a motel or caravan park with shift workers, which really is just opening up an additional potential for terrible things for that child. So it really is important that we have enough carers. The other, I guess, factor around that is looking at what the cost of that type of care is. So if you place a child in those non-family-based home settings, it actually costs the government upwards of $500,000 per child per year, sometimes $1 million per year. So really when you compare that to, let's just say, around $15,000 a year put towards caring for a child in a home, there's a huge disparity, and the outcomes for a child that misses out on the family-based home are pretty damning.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm speaking with Renee Lee, who's the CEO of Adopt Change and a member of the National Foster and Kinship Care Collective. You also have been hearing from Samantha Hoger, who's the Chief Executive of the Foster Care Association of Victoria, talking about the fact that in Victoria, at least, there are reports of people getting less money for kids with high care needs, which is really impacting on their ability to provide good quality foster care, people exiting the system. And I'm asking for your stories. If you have been part of the foster care system, I'd love to know your story. I'd love to know if you have ideas on how it could be fixed. One text says, I'm a foster carer, worse than the allowance. The system is totally broken and the support for children is dropping. There's little continuity because they're so stretched and the additional burden lands on those who care. Well, Emma is a foster carer in Brisbane. She and her husband have three kids and then also have been foster carers too. Emma, what got you interested in being a foster carer to start with?
Good morning, Tegan. I think, like a lot of people, we just wanted to be part of society. We thought it's something that we'd do when the kids were older. And then I thought, hang on, why wait? You know, like at the time we had a 3, 5, and 7-year-old, and you're totally in the throes of parenting. You're doing it all. You know, and when you've got three kids, what's another? So I guess we thought, you know, why wait? Let's do it now. We also thought it would be an amazing experience for our children, you know, just to have that empathy for others, to be kind and just be accepting of different walks of life. So, you know, I think it was just a no-brainer for us to get into, for sure.
So you've gone in, like, no one sort of goes into foster care and going, oh, I think this is going to be really easy. Like, I think people know that it's going to be a challenge, but was it the sort of challenge you were expecting?
It's been a mind-blowing experience, actually. I think nothing could have prepared us for what we were essentially getting ourselves into. I think you just have a false sense of security that you're going to be making a positive difference and it's going to be an easy road. And I think just, you know, what we hear from carers and what we hear about the system, that yes, it's very broken, the support is very minimal, and you're handed our most vulnerable kids in society. And there's so much red tape, you know. It's not as if you can just parent them the way that you'd like to, you know, parent them. Or there's just so many factors that just keep popping up. And I think it's really hard to sometimes realise that you're doing it for the right reasons, because you're just fighting against a broken system.
Do you mind, do you have an example you can give on the sort of red tape that you've faced?
I think family connection is a massive one, especially when you're dealing with the smaller, you know, the tiny people in our society that are in care, you know, talking about the newborns and the babies. And, you know, I think the department is so overloaded and so overwhelmed with their caseloads that reunification is always going to be the key, which is absolutely fantastic. But all the restraints of wanting to keep babies connected to their families but not having the resources to do it. So, you know, I think taking that time out of your own day and out of your own families, you know, week is massive, because you feel responsible for, okay, the department can't facilitate contact this week because they're overloaded. I can do it three times. So, you know, I think that you've got all this moral responsibility that you want to continuously do the right thing, but it's either all put onto you, or it's left that the department will say, oh, actually, we can't do three times a week. We can only do one. And then you've got a mother with a newborn baby that, you know, it's out of her control that she can't have the child with her. But I feel like as society, we also need to support that, which the department lacks ginormously, you know, emotionally, physically, financially, all those things that we need as carers to actually keep these kids connected. It's just not happening.
So Emma, you've had a number of babies in and out of your house over the 5 years you've been a foster carer. You don't have anyone with you at the moment, and you're really weighing up whether this is something you can continue to offer.
We are, definitely. Our carer renewal is up in 3 months' time. So, you know, I think over the last 5 years we've had some beautiful cases. We've had some cases that are just, you know, you want to bash your head against a brick wall. You feel unappreciated. You feel used. There's no continuity within the department and the people that you deal with. So, you know, you feel like no one knows these kids. And as carers, you become the advocate for them and you become their voices. But your voice is not heard. Your opinion is irrelevant. So, you know, I feel like you're fighting a broken system. And I don't know if it's easier to walk away from that, or I don't know if it's, you know, something that you just want to keep picking at. And I believe you can't complain about a situation if you're not prepared to change it. So, you know, as carers, we're sitting there going, look, emotionally and morally, we really want to do this, but, you know, the emotional toll that it has on yourself and also your kids. And I think that when you've got your own children and you do become a carer, your children are, you know, they're undervalued, they're overlooked, and they are such an important part of the system, because they are the ones that are showing these kids like some normality in society. They're the ones that, you know, share their home, they open up their rooms, they, you know, share their toys, they play games with them. They, you know, they're such a huge part, and the department, I don't know, they're so unappreciative, and I think they, you know, they could do better in the support for families. So, you know, I think that we've just experienced so many times that it's like our kids are left in emotional, you know, that emotionally they don't cope when placements move on and there's no support for them. So I think the bigger picture is not only as adults wanting to make that difference, but the impact that it has on your family and, you know, whether or not time will fix that, you know, have a year off and then go back to it. But, you know, I don't know. It's a tricky one, Tegan.
Yeah. We're talking about foster care this morning here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, about the various challenges that foster families face to remain in the system, the fact that the attrition rate is really high. And I'm asking you for your stories of fostering. A text here: we have been privileged to share our love and home with beautiful children as foster carers, but it has left us broken, and we see it breaking many children in care. The foster care agency we work with operates like a business, with a lack of child and family focus. Their casework staff are lovely but underqualified, overworked, and there's constant turnover. This means inconsistent support for us and, most importantly, for the children. The text continues, we feel so conflicted being part of the foster care system when we see that it doesn't adequately care for children, families and carers. We don't want to abandon children we love. This texter finishes, I strongly discourage anyone from being a foster carer. It's heartbreaking and harrowing. Renee, hearing someone who's obviously been part of this system actively discouraging it, how does that land for you?
Look, unfortunately, it's not a surprise. We've heard from people in some of the surveys that we've run around that it's not something that they'd recommend. The numbers for that are too high, but not surprising considering the experience. And it's typically not around their experience of caring for the child. It's their experience with being part of the system, their frustrations with that, not being given the respect and communication and transparency that they need so that they can really care for the child in their home. So what we advocate for is that there is much better support for those who are caring for Australia's most vulnerable children, and so that they are respected for the huge role that they play, and that they're able to speak positively about the experience, which is globally recognised as the best way to find new carer homes as well, is they're talking about what that experience of care has been and attracting other people in.
How could we make this system more carer and child friendly in Australia?
When we see that it works, it is around respect for the carer and making sure that they are well supported. So the role needs to be first and foremost viable. So we need to ensure that there is adequate funding for a carer to be able to sustain that role. One of the other biggest items is that often children in the care system have an experience of trauma and they need therapeutic care to heal from what they have been through. And too many of the children don't have access to that care, not readily. And carers will often be advocating for that, and they need access to that medical and therapeutic support swiftly. It is the cost of caring for a child that has had that background, so it needs to be recognised as a priority. And for carers to be listened to in terms of what their needs are, to be treated as part of the team of people and actually the ones that are there 24/7 for our kids and teens in this space. So they need to be treated as such and really listen to.
Renee, if someone's listening to this conversation and still, in spite of having their eyes open maybe to the challenges, does want to be a foster carer, what's your advice?
Look, the organisations in each state and territory vary, so people are quite welcome to have a look at our website or the websites in their state and territory to find out information and to start that conversation. It's not typically an instant decision. It can take some time to think through and figure out if it's right for you. But I think as with many of the carers, it's people that have a heart for kids that do this despite the system and despite their experience. You know, if this is the experience for carers, we can only imagine how much worse that is for children that don't have their voice and that are subject to whether it's a positive experience or a negative in the system. So there's a lot of carers that will step up, and if people are willing to do that and to take on that role, it's really something that, you know, we do need to hear from more people. And there's organisations like ours and Samantha's who support carers through that process.
Thank you all so much for sharing your stories today. Renee Lee is CEO of Adopt Change and a member of the National Foster and Kinship Care Collective. You also heard from Samantha Hogar, Chief Executive of the Foster Care Association of Victoria, and Emma, who is a foster carer. Well, coming up next on Life Matters, what is it about the weather that has us so obsessed?
Christopher Skase. Remember that name? The guy of corporate Australia in the 1980s?
Skase had an aura of success.
He came with that cowboy energy.
He owned resorts, TV stations, a footy team. Skase was on top of the business world. Until he wasn't.
Everything he built up, he lost.
The whole empire was built on debt.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bureau of Meteorology revamped its website in 2025, and to say that people had strong opinions is an understatement. Whether you like it or loathe it, the flood of your reactions showed me one thing, and that is that you love weather. It's so much more than just small talk. So what is it about the weather that has us so obsessed? Well, Nate Byrne is the ABC's very own meteorologist. You normally see him on ABC News Breakfast. Nate, what is it about this website redesign that got so much attention?
Well, who hasn't looked at the Bureau of Meteorology website at some point, right? It's the most popular government website there is, and by a long way. I mean, it's not very often that people wake up in the morning and go to something.gov.au other than the Bureau of Meteorology, because you need to figure out what it is you're going to wear. You know, weather's one of those things that really matters to people in a practical way every single day. And when the way that you get the information and the actual information that's available to you changes, I understand why people get a bit upset. I mean, for me, it's caused me an absolute nightmare. I'm having trouble finding half of the stuff that I usually use to do my job every day. But, you know, we're persevering.
I mean, it's literally your job. Not everyone gets to be a meteorologist, unfortunately. Where did your own interest in weather begin?
I think for me, it was as a kid. The meteorology and the being a television weather presenter, two very separate things. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be a TV weather presenter because I thought they only had to do 5 minutes work a day. At the end of the news, I thought that meant more time to play. I was very wrong. But the weather side of things, I think, as a kid, I grew up in WA. My parents used to take us down to the local boat harbour when there was a frontal system coming in, and we'd watch the lightning, you know, coming in over the Indian Ocean, and then try and run from, it's probably very dangerous, you know, it was the 80s, so different standards now perhaps, but we'd run from the edge of the water back to the car and try to beat the rain. You know, it was one of the things I'd love doing, especially in summer, and used to do it pretty regularly. And I think that started to get me interested in what's going on. And, you know, the weather's this huge, massive sort of problem that needs to be solved every day to try to predict the future. And I just find that such an interesting challenge that I get to do every single day.
Yeah, the forecasting part is really interesting. Forecasters do get it wrong from time to time. They're pretty good and they're better now than they used to be.
Yeah.
People love to point out when they do. How do you respond to those sorts of criticisms?
You try predicting the future. I mean, come on. I get it. The problem with forecasting is that people want to know exactly what's going to happen. And unfortunately, that's literally not possible to nail perfectly every single time. We get pretty darn close pretty darn often, which is amazing, you know, and we can give you a good idea about what's going to happen, not only over the next 24 hours, but out potentially as far as 7 days. Oh, by the way, anyone telling you anything beyond 7 days? It's rubbish.
Oh.
Don't think about it. Yep, not worth your time. There is far too much chaos in the system, and little tiny errors at the start grow really, really big, really, really quickly. So beyond 7 days, it's not worth thinking about. When there is criticism, it's often because the type of weather information that you've received hasn't really demonstrated the error bars, the left and right of arc of what's really going on. You know, when you see a forecast for a capital city that says a shower or two, the number of times people have had a, you know, written to me or had a go at me and said, hey, mate, look up, it's clear blue skies. And I have to say, yes, but it's also 11 o'clock in the morning. There's a heck of a lot more of the day to come, you know. Like, whereas if you dig into the forecast a little bit more and get it a little bit more information, then often it turns out they weren't wrong. They just, maybe you didn't get the full story about what was going to happen over any 24-hour period.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Nate Byrne, our meteorologist here at the ABC, about weather obsession, really, off the back of the bomb website redesign and the strong opinions that you have had about it. You are already sending me so many emails, texts, but I do want to read this one out from Rose, who says, one hot summer evening a few years ago, I checked the bomb for updates. The summary, an oppressive night, was so poetically astute that I sent a message to the widget on the site. Rose says, to my surprise and delight, someone, an actual real person, replied. And we had a brief discussion about language, meteorology, and the power of metaphor. Well, that's a positive story about the Bureau.
Do you know, that is one of my favourites, Tegan. It sits right next to the other one that is often comes at the same time as an oppressive night, and it's a sultry night.
Ooh,
that's an official forecast term, and I love it so much. But, you know, that's because forecast, the science of weather came long after we knew about weather and talking about weather. So we've got all of these just sort of common phrases that have moved into the science, you know, rather than having scientific phrases that then go out into the public realm. So, you know, we get things like a fine forecast, which sounds kind of dull, but it means it's a beautiful day. No rain is actually all it means. Language in the weather is always very interesting, I think.
That thing about language in the weather is so interesting and kind of the perfect segue to bring in Laurie Zion, who's also with us today. Laurie is a professor of journalism at La Trobe University and the author of a book titled The Weather Obsession. Laurie, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, Tegan, and hi, Nate.
Laurie, it's been far too long, my friend. How are you?
Good. But can I jump in on just something you said, and that is the term fine. Isn't that, Nate, one of the terms that got kind of taken out of the lexicon for forecasts because people didn't understand what a lot of people were.
It's still acceptable to be used, but, yeah, we try to be a little clearer because, that's so emotionally laden for people.
Laurie, I did want to pick up on this as well because part of what you've found in a lot of weather obsession and researching your book that came out a couple of years ago was how much more weather literate we are now. Nate was saying that we have a lot of words from our casual lexicon that have entered the weather vocabulary, but it has started to come the other way as well.
Yeah, great point, Tegan. Actually, it was about 8 or 9 years ago I wrote the book, and what I observed there was this massive change in the 21st century in the way that people access weather. First of all, you've got all these sort of passive ways of doing it. If your phone shows you a temperature when you pick it up, it may not be sourced by the Bureau of Meteorology, maybe it is. But then I think severe weather and the popularity of online articles that can kind of not just tell you what happened, but can run a running commentary on a weather event. It just means that for people to be able to understand that, they need to be able to understand the broader language. And then the terms that you mentioned come from the Southern Oscillation Index, which has always been a natural variable, if you like. But now I think people, if there's an El Nino that is called by the Bureau for the upcoming summer, which happened a couple of years ago, it becomes a real event in its own right. And what's really interesting about that is media outlets then run a whole lot of explainers, and it's incredible now how those terms have become part of the sort of, everyday language when talking about what's happening with the weather.
Yeah, people just have this vocabulary and knowledge that I just didn't have it before. Yeah. On the text line, Andrew says, I'm a farm contractor. The weather, current and the next few days are critical to the effective performance of my business. Before the recent changes to the BOM website, I could clearly see the current rain radar and wind conditions allowing me to plan for the next few hours, the day ahead, or even the next week. The new website may have that information available, but not all in one place. I don't understand how an upgrade can be a retrograde step in providing information to a community that needs it. And Clonton from Cootamundra says, for pilots like me, our lives and those of our passengers depend on accurate and easily accessible weather forecasts and reports. The fundamental mistake made by BOM was to roll out the changes with no warning to users. Nate, it's a safety issue.
It is, and actually there were a couple of things there. People probably ignored it, but for quite a bit of time there was a banner on the top of the website saying that there was this new website that was going to be launched. It had the date. There was a beta version that you could click through to have a look at. So they had given some warning. I'm not necessarily suggesting that it was done the best way it could have been done, but there was some. And all of the information, almost all of the information is still there. Certainly the safety critical stuff. So aviation, yes, 100%. Weather is everything. And if you happen to be an aviator, you can still find all of those warnings, all the TAFs, pilots know what I'm talking about. That's all still there. It's just where you have to click to get to it might have changed, but it is still there. The thing is, Tegan, the website, the old website, wasn't good. It really was a pain in the bum to steer around and to find information. But once you did, and once you knew how to get that specific bit of information that you specifically needed, then it all of a sudden felt easy. But I mean, they've replaced an awful website with one that's not servicing the customers in the way that the customers are expecting, I think.
So much of how we interact with any website is about muscle memory. Laurie, you're in journalism and communication and the way we communicate weather. Do you think it's just about people's expectations when they log on?
It's probably not just about that. I think, it's true. It's a safety issue in a lot of contexts. But I think that it is also a cultural icon, the Bureau of Meteorology. A couple of years ago, when we were told, we can't call it the bomb, what struck me as odd about that request was that it's a real compliment. It's called the bomb. It's a major cultural institution. And I would argue one step further, it's a major media organisation in its own right. So actually, if the rest of the media, and please don't let this happen, but if the rest of the media disappeared overnight, all the material that we would need to understand what's going on in the weather would still be there. And I think in the latest Bureau of Meteorology annual report, I think they had got to a point, and I'm not entirely sure, but of the significance of these figures taken on their own. But over 80% of community people reported the Bureau's services are easy to use, and 92% of emergency management customers surveyed have a good perception of the Bureau.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with a Professor of Journalism at La Trobe University, author of The Weather Obsession, Laurie Zion, and ABC meteorologist Nate Byrne, talking about why we're so obsessed with the weather, what role it plays in our lives, not just when we're outside, but also the things we talk about, the things that we care to know about. Kim in the Yarra Valley says, "My obsession started young. I come from a surfing, camping, skiing, and outdoor activity family. The bomb saved my family's lives in the 2009 Black Saturday bushfires. We were able to make a positive decision not to be in Marysville that day." And Rachel from Nam says, "I love the weather. How would I know when the perfect washing day is without the weather? It shapes our lives, and it's the one common denominator with every single living thing in our area. How amazing." And she says, "It is, in fact, the perfect washing day today." Nate, you are an admin for a social media group called Weather Obsessed that's run by the ABC. More than 170,000 followers. How do you think social media has changed the way we talk about the weather?
Oh, it's brought weather from around the world to our doorsteps and means that we get a way to see how it's affecting people. And I'm talking specifically here severe weather, but then I guess also an amazing sunrise or, a funny looking cloud in the sky or some weird phenomenon where the sun's causing a halo. Those are things that you don't necessarily get to see yourself every day, but they're often happening somewhere in the world. And social media means that those things don't have to be filtered through a time-limited media organisation. You can just show pretty things because you want to show pretty things, but then also you can get insights into the wild weather that's going on for someone. We're always interested because if it can happen to someone else, it could happen to us as well, I think. That's why we are drawn to things like the news and to emergencies around the world because we've got an interest to learn from them in case we have to face that same sort of thing one day.
And on extreme weather, the climate has changed in our lifetimes and I think we're starting to see and remember that now. Do you think that that's impacted the kind of the stakes when we're talking about weather?
Oh, for sure. I mean, we're setting records all the time, whether it's heat or rainfall or flooding or, we're setting them at a faster rate than we should be, really. And, the stakes are the highest they've ever been. I mean, for more and more of us, things like summer, it's becoming a time to survive rather than to thrive and have a holiday and chill. It's literally life and death and becoming increasingly so as time progresses.
Laurie, I'm interested. One of the things that you've looked at in your research is the variations of who is interested in the weather depending on where they live. And I have noticed on the text line, at least, quite a few people saying that they're from Nam. Is that representing what you saw?
Yeah, I think the people in Nam, like me, are very aware of the four seasons in one day motif. The research has been done on all of this. It was actually done in the US, but the finding from that is people who have, you know, cold fronts followed by hot days, in other words, where the weather might be quite changeable, are much more likely or somewhat more likely to actually be really interested in what's happening on a daily basis. So that said, I do think if you're in Darwin, I went to Darwin as part of the research for this book, and it was just in the build-up period. So people were obsessed by the weather there because, firstly, 36 feels a lot hotter than 34 there when they had those days, but also the thunderstorms coming in, when will the monsoon start, all those different things. So some people would probably be more episodically interested in the weather in a particular time of year. But where you've got a climate like what we have in Victoria, Tasmania, Canberra, it means that you really don't know. The weather you've got outside today, which is beautiful, maybe won't last, you know, more than today or even today. And in fact, there's a lot of rain in the forecast at the moment. So people need that information, I think, in order to make even, you know, what might be seen as non-consequential decisions, like what to wear to work, whether to eat outside, do a picnic or whatever. But I wouldn't call these things trivial. I think it's very much part of our culture, the weather, and the information that weather services such as the Bureau provide, I think is genuinely useful to people. And so in that context, I think when people feel that it's harder to reach that information or that there's been a big change, then definitely they're going to react to that.
Laurie, Nate, thank you both so much for joining me. Laurie Zion is a professor of journalism at La Trobe University and the author of a book called The Weather Obsession, and Nate Byrne, meteorologist on ABC News Breakfast. Thank you for your texts. Helen says, my mood is very much governed by the weather. A windy day does my head in. I'm a weather forecaster tragic. And Chris says, I wish that as a society we'd stop seeing rain as bad weather. I understand the implications for farmers and people working on the land, but rain and storms can be very beautiful. Well, next up on Life Matters, TV icon Suzanne Summers died in 2023, but now she's back as an AI clone.
Tasmanian salmon. It's on dinner plates across Australia. And it's a billion-dollar business with jobs for Tassie. But it's a lightning rod for locals too, concerned about its environmental impact. Radio National's next citizen jury comes from the Huon Valley, where citizens share their solutions. Join me, Natasha Mitchell, for Citizen Jury on Big Ideas. Look for Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app.
Suzanne Summers was one of the biggest TV stars of the 1980s and 1990s. She starred on sitcoms like Three's Company and Step by Step, and she also made a name for herself by marketing the iconic fitness gadget, the Thighmaster. Well, sadly, Susan died of cancer in 2023, but now her husband of 46 years has brought her back, kind of. Summers' widower, Alan Hamill, has created an AI clone of her, saying that when he sees the two of them side by side, even he can't tell which is real and which is AI. He plans to upload her to be a 24/7 AI chatbot for her fans. So what are the ethical implications of creating an AI bot of a loved one? Well, Patrick Stokes is an associate professor of philosophy at Deakin University. He's back in our regular segment that I call Ask Aristotle. Pat, could Aristotle even fathom this conversation?
Well, no, but he did have some views on the dead and whether the dead can be harmed or benefited and things like that. So even some of these seemingly really modern problems, and they are very kind of, you know, contemporary sort of problems, they even they have kind of antecedents that go right back into the philosophical canon.
Oh my gosh, that's so interesting. Well, I want to get to that, but first, when you first heard about this AI, Susan Summers, what was your, like, visceral reaction at first?
Yeah, well, I have to admit, this is actually a topic that I've been working on for about 15 years, for quite a while now.
Susan Summers AI.
Not Susan Summers, but not Susan Summers specifically, no. It's not Thigh Master Studies, but no, I've been interested in, for a very long time, in digital death and the way in which we use what people call our digital remains, the things that we leave behind when we die and how we remediate those, how we like use them in AI and in memorials and things like that. I've been working on that topic for, yeah, quite a long time now, as have a great many other people, I should say. And just in the last 12, 18 months, suddenly everyone wants to talk about this. So it's been a good time for people working on the topic of digital death. And I'm currently doing a three-year ARC-funded project called Digital Death and Immortality here at Deakin Uni. And so this is one that sort of came up, and me and the other people on the team were like, oh, hey, did you see that thing about Susan Summers? And it's interesting in the sense that on the one hand, this is something a lot of people are doing. A lot of very ordinary people are doing this as well. They're setting up AI bots of loved ones as part of their grieving process. We've been talking about this as a looming technology, as I say, for nearly 15 years. And then probably about 18 months ago, people went, oh, hang on, they're already doing it commercially at scale in China. Yeah. So this is already happening. This is already a thing. It's loomed. The problem has loomed. And so the Susan Summers one is not that new in that sense, but the fact that it's Susan Summers, the fact that it's high profile, and the fact that her husband, Alan Hamill, has got these really big plans for this bot are really quite fascinating, some of which look really speculative, but it is a really interesting example.
When I first heard this idea of anyone being a 24/7 chatbot, I was just like, oh, can't that poor woman just have a break now? Like, obviously it's not her, I know that, but this idea of resting in peace feels really hard if anyone, any huge number of people could be theoretically talking to you at any time of the day forever.
Yeah, this is actually a huge problem. There's a worry that chatbots in general and death bots in particular, we call them death bots. In our project, we call them IPCDs, interactive personality constructs of the dead, but that doesn't
death
exactly...
Death bots, snappier for sure.
Yeah, let's go with death bots for the moment. There's a worry that because they're always on, because they're always available, and that's true of AI in general, there's a worry that that will actually distort our sense of what we can expect from people. That will actually, like, you know, real flesh and blood people who aren't always there, who seem to sleep sometimes and sometimes don't answer your messages immediately or leave you on bread or whatever, may not be as satisfying to us as AI. And there's a real kind of worry there that'll either change our etiquette or it will make us just generally disappointed in real people and start to prefer AI. But there's also just this general question too of, should Susan Summers have to keep doing this? Should she have to keep working, you know, after she's died? That sounds silly in a way, but it's a legit question. One of the things her husband's floated is he said, well, now I've got an AI of Susan Summers, why can't we get the estate of John Ritter to make an AI of the actor John Ritter, who died of a heart attack on the set of 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter some years ago, and put them both in to do some new episodes of Three's Company, the show they were doing in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's like, yeah, or we could let these people not do that. And like, not actually kind of exploit the dead to do new episodes of things. There are, at the very least, there are some serious questions about the propriety of doing that.
Okay, so this is what you were talking about before. You were like, Aristotle even thought about whether it's possible to harm the dead. If honestly, like, it feels crass to talk about it, and with all respect to these people who have loved and have gone, but what difference does it really make to monetize their likeness if they're not here anymore?
Well, this is an interesting thing. I find people kind of split into two camps. So some people are with that sort of Aristotle view, according to which Aristotle said it would be heartless to claim that the dead are not harmed or benefited by things like the fortunes of their descendants, for instance. And a lot of us have those intuitions that, for instance, if you find out somebody was wrongly hanged for a crime they didn't commit 100 years ago, there's a sense in which exonerating them is the right thing to do for them. not just for everyone else who's alive now, but also for them. It's a good thing to do for them, to restore their name. Equally, if you slander someone who's dead, it seems like you're harming them. When they were alive, they had an interest in having a good reputation, and you're harming that reputation. So some people fall into that camp. Other people side with one of Aristotle's students, Epicurus, and say, yeah, you know what? If you can't experience it, it doesn't matter. Mm. Right. So if you can't, and if the dead can't experience things like being slandered or being praised, then you're not actually harming or benefiting them. So it doesn't really matter. So if you want to use a chatbot of someone who's long dead and exploit their image in that way, who cares? I'm kind of more in the former camp, but I kind of also get where people are coming from who are in that Epicurean side as well.
And so I suppose one of the things that lies behind this is that someone who lived 100 years ago would not have even known how to say that their wishes were like, please don't make an AI chatbot of me.
Yeah.
But these days we do have that, and that's actually something that some of your colleagues have looked at.
Yeah, so there's this interesting question about whether or not you can have how much autonomy you can have over this process. For some people, you know, before they die, they might say, yeah, go ahead and clone me after I die. Set up an AI chatbot based on me. That's fine. Or even you can do it now before I die. And with Susan Summers, that seems to have been the case, actually, that they talked about it before she died. Apparently, she and her husband were friends with Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, and they'd talked about this years ago. So this is something she was apparently kind of on board with. Other people have done that. William Shatner's done a similar thing. So you can go down that path. On the other hand, this is a question of after somebody's died, is it okay to do it? And to a certain extent, it comes down to a kind of relationship of stewardship. You know, in a way, we have a kind of responsibility to steward the dead who are kind of handed over into our care. Like, so, and that can be as simple as organising someone's funeral, right? Deciding how that funeral is going to be. It's a kind of stewardship. And in that sense, you can say you're making a decision on behalf of the person whether or not it's okay to make a chatbot out of them. Interesting question about whether anyone should have the authority to do that. And if so, who has the authority? What happens if people within a family disagree? And this is some of the stuff we're trying to work on in this project, is coming up with some sort of ethical frameworks to put around this stuff. But there's also an interesting question of whether people should have the right to say preemptively before they die, no, when I die, delete my stuff, do not reanimate me. Deborah Bassett, who's a researcher who works on this stuff in the UK, has slightly cheekily called these digital do not resuscitate orders. So just as you can get an order when you go into hospital saying, if my heart stops, don't resuscitate me, just let me go, there's an interesting question of whether people should be able to say, if I die, I don't want any AI recreations of me after I die, and exerting authority that way. And one of the problems here is just that the law is way behind the technology here in most jurisdictions. At best, there's some protection for celebrities. There's New York State, for instance, if you're a celebrity and you die because your image has monetary value, you can actually, or your estate does have an automatic right to control how that image is used. Now, that's only just come in, including AI uses. But for ordinary people, there's really no kind of protection beyond just intellectual property law, and it's a real problem that we don't have protections of people against this stuff.
So that's like my choice about my, you know, digital image. But then we also have seen recently, just staying with the celebrity theme, Robin Williams' daughter Zelda has asked fans to stop sending her AI-generated videos of her dad. It can disrupt people's grieving process.
Yeah, there's an interesting question around whether these technologies, which are sometimes presented to us as technologies for helping with grief, and particularly now that prolonged grief disorder, so grief that goes on too long or is too kind of disruptive, is actually recognised as a medical condition, according to the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual 5. Because of that, there's a suggestion that these technologies can be used to help people with their grief, to help them learn to move on or to renegotiate their relationship with a dead person, which, when you think about it, is kind of what grieving is. There's a very provocative paper from 2022 from a Swedish grad student named Laura Lindemann, then grad student, in which she said, oh, okay, well, she's kind of calling people's bluff on this and saying, if you think these are techniques or technologies for dealing with extended grief, then we're talking about medical technologies and they should be regulated as such. So if you want to use a death bot, you need to get a prescription from a psychiatrist, because otherwise, we just don't let people use medical technologies or therapeutic technologies without regulation, which I think is a really interesting point. If that's what they're meant to be, then they need to be regulated.
So, Pat, would you sign a digital DNR? Or can we talk to you on Life Matters in perpetuity if you ever do shuffle off?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in two minds about it. On the one hand, I don't think anyone would bother setting up a bot to, unless it was to yell at me. But on the other hand, I'm kind of like, you know, there are going to be uses of the technology that I can't imagine right now. And saying no preemptively to things that you can't imagine might actually be more problematic than just leaving it open-ended and leaving it to the goodwill of your stewards.
Another ethical minefield we'll have to leave for another day. Pat, as always, thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks, Tegan.
Patrick Stokes is an associate professor of philosophy at Deakin University. Our regular chats are called Ask Aristotle. Well, thank you for your texts. Joy from Warrnambool says, a deceased loved one chatbot would mess with my head and grieving process. I feel I would remain in a suspended state, unable to mourn their physical loss. We also talked earlier about the weather, and one person has texted in saying, I used to work on managing very large and sometimes noisy events which were required to have noise monitoring. We rarely had any problems, but one New Year's Day, we were overwhelmed with complaints from as far away as 7Ks as the crow flies, despite complying with regulations. We couldn't figure out what was going on until I asked a fellow public servant at the bomb if there were any weird weather conditions. There had been a temperature inversion in Sydney that day, causing a border of hot and cold air that the music was sliding along for kilometres. This person signs off, love the bomb. Well, that is it for Life Matters today on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow, we'll discuss changes to the way we care for our nation's older people and the way we use apps to monitor our little ones in childcare centres. You can catch up on any of the stories on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Life Matters, and I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.